The kiss that Theodore Roosevelt longed for did not materialize when he stepped ashore in Khartoum on 14 March 1910. Instead, he had to return the salute of Sir Rudolf Anton Karl von Slatin Pasha, GCVO, KCMG, CB, Inspector General of the Sudan, and pass an honor guard of Askaris into the palace garden, where the elite of Anglo-Sudanese society awaited him amid the silver paraphernalia of afternoon tea. He was informed that Edith's train from Cairo was delayed, and that she and Ethel would not arrive for another couple of hours. In the meantime, Slotin could not hear of the colonel checking into a hotel. A suite for his party had been readied in the palace, and a private yacht was standing by for sightseeing during his stay. What Roosevelt wanted to see more than anything but Edith's face was Omdurman. The battlefield, where General Kitchener's 21st Lancers had staged the last great cavalry charge of the 19th century, lay only 10 miles away. Kitchener had been on his mind in recent days, if only because HMS Dal, the boat that had brought him north from Gondokoro, had been the triumphant commander's flagship. On its boards, 12 years before, Kitchener had proclaimed British control over the entire Nile Valley, from Uganda to the Mediterranean. The success of that dominion, or condominium, as the Foreign Office called it, as a sop to Sudanese, Egyptian, and Turkish sensibilities, was palpable in Khartoum's tranquil, orange-blossom-scented air. Rebuilt by Kitchener from the ruins of a 13-year Muslim interregnum, the city was laid out like the Union Jack, its crossbars lined with stone villas and its triangles filled with 7,000 trees. Once the most violent flashpoint on the African continent, it now lazily breathed Pax Britannica. In the sun-burned aristocratic faces of his hosts, in their perfect manners and air of unstudied authority, Roosevelt recognized the attributes he had always admired in the English ruling class, along with intelligence, ability, and a very lofty sense of duty. Yet he was aware of the constant menace of Arab nationalism, obscure yet encircling, like the mirages wavering on the desert horizon. The haze that hung over the city seemed, to his vivid historical imagination, to be red with the blood of General Gordon, murdered in this very palace by modest dervishes. Khartoum's North Station was cordoned off when he met the Cairo Express at 5:30 p.m. He climbed into his wife's private car the moment it came to a halt and remained inside for a long time. Finally, the two of them emerged arm in arm, with Kermit and Ethel close behind. All four Roosevelts were laughing. Edith's smile transformed her normally stiff public face, exposing perfect teeth and lighting up the blue of her eyes. At 48, she was no longer slender, but had just enough height to carry off the consequences of never having had to cook for herself, and her wrists and ankles and sharp profile were as elegant as ever. She had suffered during her year-long separation from Theodore, more from worry about him on safari than distress about herself. Books and music and children had always been her solace. That evening, Roosevelt changed into a tuxedo and replaced the wire spectacles he had worn on safari with beribboned pince-nez. Transformed thus, he looked dapper for the first time in nearly a year, and worthy of the place card that confronted him at Slatin Pasha's table. The Honorable Colonel Roosevelt. So far, he had managed to keep at bay the reporters that Henry Cabot Lodge had warned him about. They were clamoring for statements on a hot local news item, the murder by a nationalist student of Egypt's Coptic Prime Minister, Boutros Ghali Pasha. Roosevelt had heard about this incident before arriving in Khartoum. He was not unwilling to speak about it, but preferred to wait until he made a scheduled address on the issue of condominium at Cairo University in 2 weeks' time. As for commenting on American issues, he needed first to go through a fat sack of telegrams and letters from home. John Callan O'Laughlin of the Chicago Tribune had collated the sack and was offering to serve as his traveling stenographer, as F. Warrington Dawson had in British East Africa. Roosevelt was fond of O'Laughlin, an experienced foreign policy man, and admired his sass. It had been Cal who, scattering piastres like couscous, chartered the steamboat that met the Dal at Arunk. However, another contender for secretarial honors was at hand, Lawrence F. Abbott, president of The Outlook. Roosevelt felt that, as an employee of that magazine himself, He was listed in its masthead as contributing editor. He could not turn Abbott down. His work for Scribner's magazine was done, and he must look to the Outlook for income, and, not incidentally, space to promulgate his political views. So O'Laughlin was consoled with a promise of special access, the press corps invited to accompany the Omdurman excursion, and Abbott granted a close-up position from which to observe and record the colonel's return to public life.